this is my entire point with Uber, is that their executive team and their culture is trying to solve for a problem where their primary competitor is going to literally poop millions of self-driving units per year while they try to aggregate 50,000 of them.
Why are you trying to work with Waymo, like all these other companies, but you're not working with Comma? That makes no sense to me. And it, like, that tells me that their taste in what technology solution is ultimately going to dominate this market is absolute.
Uber tried to beat Grab in Southeast Asia in 2018 and they lost. Like, big, you know, $200 billion company Uber had to leave the region and take an equity stake in the company because they weren't able to assimilate to the cultural values, all that type of stuff.
That is my prediction. And I will say it again, Amit, on this podcast, Uber is going to zero. I don't know when, but it's going to zero. I remember, so last time we had you on, we talked Tesla, we talked Palantir, we talked Hoodie,
yep.
The Hoodster.
Yes, sir.
Earlier this week, I went on your channel and made your audience feel like I am the biggest lunatic on the planet, which I really deeply enjoyed. So Hans, just so you know, I went, Tuesday, right? Tuesday, yeah. When they launched RoboTaxi, I was heading down to Capital Factory and, you know, the whole thing. And I went on a midstream and I basically told everyone that Uber's fucking dead. And people are like, you are the biggest blowhard.
He said they're going to zero. I was
zero.
Like, and I corrected him. I was like, you know, so far as that, you're not saying they're dead. You're saying they have some competitive problems. He was like, no, I'm saying they're dead.
Yeah. And I was, okay, give me your honest take on that. Like, don't sugarcoat it. Like, give me like the honest take based on my thesis and how I communicated it. I know you're always very nice to me because you're just a nice guy, but just lay it to me straight. Like, punch me in the face. Like, can you poke holes in my thesis? Like, where do you think I'm wrong?
I don't think Uber is dead simply because network effects are really hard to establish and they've got those network effects. But I do see the argument that if Tesla, in a flip of a switch, even if it's 5 years from now instead of 5 months from now, can have hundreds of thousands of vehicles inside of a robotaxi network autonomously that are turned on, which is the supply side of the network that is so hard to build. Like, Netflix is winning because they built their own content, right? They have that supply side, and that's why it's hard for Hulu and HBO to keep up. They have to keep licensing other people's content. That's what makes Netflix special and, more importantly, profitable. I think if Tesla can do that, if we're entering into a self-driving autonomous world where that is the de facto way people travel, distribution's not going to be hard because Elon has a lot of followers and attention, and it's Tesla. It's a worldwide brand. And if the cost per mile goes down, I do think that's easily replicatable. Now, I don't think that kills Uber because Uber's going to partner with a lot of other companies that are in this self-driving space. But the question is, if those self-driving experiences like a Waymo is not the type of experience like a Tesla, it doesn't kill them. It just means their market share is not going to grow as dramatically as some of the Uber bulls think it's going to grow. So I don't think they're dead, but I also don't think they're going
to. But what does that do to their valuation if they go from being a growing company to a shrinking company?
That's a good point. I mean, but here's the thing. Like companies getting delisted off the stock market or bankrupt, like, that's just really hard to do when you have a brand as powerful as, I mean, this app has been number two or number one on the App Store in at least the United States for the past 5 years. Like, it's Airbnb and Uber, and then I think it's like United Airlines and a couple other, like, it's a brand that is so universally known, and there's not gonna be Tesla FSD in India, not anytime soon, right? So I'm like, maybe eventually, but not anytime. So Uber is a, I was just in India 8 months ago, Uber is a big player. So that's what I mean by it's not gonna be dead. But valuation wise when we talk about exponential growth, yeah, I mean, I'd rather own Tesla stock.
So here, let me make the tangential case for Uber's path to not only survive, but thrive. And I don't know that they're going to do this or not. But, you know, I've been thinking a lot about competition for these markets that RoboTaxi is moving into. And everyone, you know, we think about, hey, like, Tesla RoboTaxi is going to be way more competitive than Uber's with human drivers, or Uber, like, you know, it's cheaper to drive a cyber cab to someone's house with an Optimus in it and have the Optimus robot, you know, go take the In-N-Out burger up to someone's door and drop it off and leave than it is for Uber. But we're just in this era of massive disruption and technological disruption. And I think companies like Zipline, for example, like, that's a way better technological first principle solution to deliver In-N-Out burgers to someone's house than
for those
a cyber cab
familiar,
and an Optimus.
With Zip, so what is exactly Zipline? Like, what is their offering?
Zipline is the Amazon drone delivery company that Jeff Bezos promised us and failed to deliver, and it's real. They have been delivering packages for a decade now, roughly, have done millions of deliveries, millions and millions of miles traveled, zero human safety incidents. They went and set up in the country of Rwanda to do delivery of health supplies to hospitals, kind of as their first use case a number of years ago. And so they would do, I think it primarily started with just blood. So they would transport blood from the main capital city out to all these remote hospitals and stuff. And because Rwanda invited them in, you know, they worked with them on all the aviation rules and regulations and helped facilitate all of this. They worked, you know, on a very hard and important problem. And so they were able to like fully debug their process, their, you know, de-risk the technology itself, get everything really ramped up. They had a, you know, a good customer base. They've been ramping up with revenue. Like, you know, they have been operating this business now, and it's a legitimate business. And so they've got the technology is down. It works. It's great. The high level concept is you've got this drone that it is a quadcopter drone mixed with a normal, you know, what you would think of an airplane would look like, where you've got wings and a tail and, you know, a propeller in the back that pushes. But then they have that with then four rotors, kind of two in front of the wings, two behind the wings, that face upward so that it can take off and land vertically, but then it can fly very efficiently forward. And what it does, so that allows it to use a lot less energy to go long distances with your payload. And so they can go to the In-N-Out Burger. They have a pod underneath it that is on a winch that goes up and down. And so they can fly right up to the In-N-Out Burger. The In-N-Out Burger has this little window. They drop the pod into the window. The In-N-Out Burger puts your food in the pod. Then it retracts that back up into the drone. The drone flies over your house and it stays like 200 feet in the air. So you don't see it, you don't hear it. And then this pod just lowers. They can hit a dinner plate on your lawn as far as accuracy. And they can drop off. They could, like, you could literally set your plate outside on your patio and Zipline can drop your burger on your plate and then fly off and go do the next thing. And so, like, you just think about this from a first principle standpoint. This drone weighs 20 pounds. It's transporting your 5-pound meal and it's flying directly to you. It's not having to go through traffic. It's not having to wait at red lights. So, like, your food is going to get to you way faster because they're traveling in a direct line to you. And it's going to, so it's going to be hotter, fresher, all of that stuff. And then the energy that they're consuming to transport your food to you is a lot less because the thing that's doing the transporting weighs 20 pounds instead of 3,000 pounds. So anyways, like, that's, these are the types of competitive threats to use cases that are going to, a lot of people are going to used to justify, like, CyberCab can do anything and everything. Like, we're just going to think, hey, CyberCabs are the end-all be-all solution to all human transportation of stuff problems. And in my, I think that there is going to be other stuff that's like this. Thank you to the sponsor of today's podcast, Rebellion Air. We know that a lot of you in our audience are big-time Tesla investors, but just because you're willing to make a big bet on a single company, that doesn't mean that you don't think about how to manage your risk to the downside. And let's face it, once that big concentrated Tesla position grows to be worth $1 million or more, it can definitely be a good time to bring in some professional help. But who can you hire that isn't going to give you cookie cutter advice or scold you for not being diversified enough? That's where Rebellion Air can help. Bradford Ferguson and Matt Smith are big time retail investors like you, and they've done tons of unique and insightful research around things like Tesla's FSD and energy, so they understand exactly where your conviction comes from. But they're also professionals, and through Rebellion Air, They specialize in helping investors like you with big concentrated investments to protect yourself from the downside risk while growing your share count over time using strategies like trimming and adding or covered calls. Not only that, but they can also help you to create a money master plan from your financial first principles. If that sounds interesting to you and you've got $1 million position or more in a company like Tesla, you can head on over to rebellionaire.com/Farzad using the link in the description to let them know that we sent you. That's rebellionaire.com/Farzad. And now, back to the podcast. That if Uber wants to buy a company like Zipline and then go buy up Joby and Archer and all these other companies that, you know, get into the human VTOL ride-sharing space, which is kind of an easier application to solve the autonomy in. The hard thing is actually getting VTOLs that are safe with humans at scale. And this is what Travis always wanted to do. But these kind of orthogonal sources of competition to Tesla Robotaxi, like there is a possibility for a company like Uber to then, you know, bring their distribution network and be fast adopters of these technologies
of non-ground transportation.
Yes,
but they have to go down that direction. They have to pull the lever to do that. Are there any clues or any decisions by the executive team that are pointing them towards that direction of moving away from ground transportation and adopting things like drones, as an example? Is there anything out there that Uber's saying we're going to do that? I don't think so. And that's my entire point. Is that
unless, I mean, this is what got Travis run out of the company, isn't it? That he wanted to keep investing money in this kind of stuff. And
he got ran out of the company. This is my point. This is my entire point with Uber, is that their executive team and their culture is trying to solve for a problem where their primary competitor is going to literally shit millions of self-driving units per year while they try to aggregate 50,000 of them. That's the issue with Uber. They just will not have the scale to compete at the price, right? So, I mean, we'll see. And then the justification becomes, okay, in markets where you have human labor for driving that is very, very low, like say your Indias and your Chinas, et cetera, does Uber... Can Uber work in those countries? Of course it can. But you're telling me that valuation for that company is going to be vastly different than the valuation for like a Tesla. And then in addition to that, once that self-driving company that is producing millions of units per year goes in that market with their app, because why on earth would they ever give up their product and their pricing power to somebody else? What happens to Uber then?
Do you think you're wrong at all that Elon and Uber won't partner in some way?
I just don't understand why Elon would want to give up control of the Tesla network in any way, shape, or form when he has openly said multiple times that if you want to operate a robotaxi, it has to be done on the Tesla network. And if you think about it from a pricing power perspective, why are you allowing somebody else to dictate the price of the car to the end user? And then in the case of an Uber, for Uber to work, like,
or own the customer experience.
Exactly. And when you're talking about Tesla, like Elon, I think from a cultural perspective, like how he sets the tone of the company, if it's important, they do it. And there's nothing more important with Tesla than customer experience, because that's what sells the product. That's why they don't advertise. It's because of us, because Hans and I, two lunatics, are out there talking about how great this company is on our own volition, because of how incredible the product is. Why on earth would you ever give that up?
It's a good point. Look, I agree. From a stock picker's perspective, there's no way in hell I'd buy Uber over Tesla. It's just like, it's obvious to me. The timeline on flipping on that robotaxi network could take some time, in which Uber still captures their market share, puts up their free cash flow, all that stuff. But the inevitability, and I think we're seeing this right now with Apple, dude. Like, one of my good friends, Steve, who comes on my channel a lot, last night he finally said, admit, because I've been giving him shit about Apple for years, he's like, you're right. He saw the liquid glass stuff at WWDC. He was like, you know what? Vision Pro didn't work. Siri's a mess. They have no AI mode. Like, I can't. What the fuck is going on over there?
Yeah.
How could you buy Apple over in NVIDIA? And so when it comes to Uber, Tesla, if Uber does not have the type of supply that Tesla has or the AI that Tesla has, like, it really is tough to bet on good free cash flow in 2025 versus the future in 2035. 100%.
Like, Uber is limited by drivers. And and self-driving companies that are willing to manufacture self-driving cars to put on Uber's network. That is their supply. And the only way to increase the supply of self-driving cars is by forcing them to make as many as Tesla. That doesn't seem like an attainable thing. Because once that company can make enough, can match up with Tesla, they'll just come up with their own app. Because then they can create their own thing. You know, they can create their own economies of scale with that. So anyway, I don't want to rehash the points we've been talking about on the stream. So
I was just curious on Uber's strategy. Like, why are they not investing in contracting with Comma AI? Like, that makes no sense to me.
I agree.
Like, why are you trying to work with Waymo, like all these other companies, but you're not working with Comma? That makes no sense to me. And it, like, that tells me that their taste in what technology solution is ultimately going to dominate this market is absolute shit. Like, their technical judgment is dog shit.
Yeah. But I don't know. People don't see it. I think a lot of people are still sort of on this thing. It's like, hey, you know, stock is what, near all-time highs or all-time highs or something?
When it was at 60, this is when Bill Ackman bought 30 million shares. Like, from his perspective, it was undervalued, which it was. And now it's at like 90. But in 5 years, with all the stuff going around with Tesla, if they figure this part out, I wonder how an Ackman thinks of it. Because he's not a dumb guy. He just, you know, he can't buy Tesla because the multiples are too aggressive. But I wonder if he sees where the future's going and if he should at least hold on to the stake in Uber that he still has.
What do you think is the best value stock on the market right now? Like, and that's not being talked about enough. You can't say Palantir.
Yeah, it's
Is it NVIDIA?
Dude, my conviction on NVIDIA is getting deeper and deeper. I mean, like, this.
Why?
The statistics I'm seeing in regards to the use of LLMs, one came out yesterday, ChatGPT has a 90% retention rate. So 9 out of 10 people every month that they sign up, they come back. The only other product in history that it has anything close to a 90% retention rate is YouTube with 85%. So whether you love ChatGPT or not, the point is Grok, Anthropic, all these LLMs are taking away the attention we had on traditional products and services, and they're bringing us into the AI supercomputer world that we're in, and it's the worst it's ever going to be. And so NVIDIA is the backbone of all of that. And, you know, we can talk about humanoids, all that stuff, but like this is going to be it's not a cyclical AI story. Oracle just said they're going to grow 100% on the remaining performance obligations next year, 40% cloud computing growth, 70% enterprise database suite growth. Like, it is going to be insanity, the types of growth we're going to see across the entire sector. And all of that comes down to hyperscalers, models, GPUs to support all that. So I think NVIDIA is like one of my biggest convictions right now. So that's why I'm bullish. In terms of value stocks too, I don't know. Like, a stock that's not being talked about enough that is special. I mean, there's one that I like a lot called Grab, but we can get into that. But UNH, I think, is cheap, even though it fell 50%. But like, in terms of technology stocks that have no hype that are going to be really special, I think the entire world is focused so deeply on these AI names and hyper analyzing them every day that it's hard to find a real undervalued one right now.
What does Grab do? Sorry, Hans, go. You go.
No, let's do Grab first, and then we'll come back to this.
Yeah.
So ironically, Grab is the Uber of Southeast Asia. And
thank you. Thank you for reconfirming my thesis. Go for it.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's more so a bet on the nature of the company. It's a $20 billion company. They have $9 billion in cash. In Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Thailand, Philippines, you don't have any FSD coming soon. Now, eventually that will be there. And they've already done partnerships with AV companies, et cetera. I don't know if Tesla is going to take over that market until they take over the Northeast market or the European market. I mean, like, Southeast Asia, the problem is Tesla's not going to make a lot of money in Southeast Asia. Like, the disposable income there is not that dramatic. And so you kind of need, and Uber tried to beat Grab in Southeast Asia in 2018, and they lost. Like, big, you know, $200 billion company Uber had to leave the region and take an equity stake in the company because they weren't able to assimilate to the cultural values, all that type of stuff.
This is ticker symbol Grab,
GRE. Mobility, financial services, they have a ton of banking products, and then they're a deliveries app. They're a super app. So, you know, WeChat in China, that's what they are for Southeast Asia. And I've fallen in love with the financials. I love the founder. The stock's been stuck at $4 for 5 years. At some point, I think it breaks out. They just raised $1 billion and $1.5 billion. I think they're going to use that money to acquire other companies, increase their margins, all that stuff. So to me, it's more of a financial value play. It's not like this big darling AI tech company. And I think the downside is limited. So it's kind of safe in my portfolio because I have so much risk with NVIDIA, Palantir, and Hood, et cetera. But yeah, I mean, look, FSD is a threat to them. I just think that threat is a bit farther away until it actually scales in North America and Europe and then eventually can go across the world.
Yeah. So it's literally the Uber of second and third tier economic countries.
Yeah. And because those countries don't have a big population that's becoming digitally native, like it's growing, but it's not as sophisticated. I mean, these guys are just trying to figure out what it means to incorporate into a digital economy. And so the Grab has like 90% ratings in terms of their brand presence. Like they've become a virtual monopoly in the region. And so they're not priced like it. It was a $20 billion company with $10 billion in cash. To me, it's like,
wow,
it's kind of obvious that in a couple of years, this thing gets at least 40, 50 billion.
And they're making a profit?
Yeah, they just turned profitable three quarters. So they weren't profitable for the past couple of years. And they just turned profitable three quarters ago. A net adjusted EBITDA profitable, GAAP profitable, free cash flow is at like $800 million. Like all the metrics I care about as like a value investor are inflecting up into the right. Howard Marks, legendary investor, just bought 10 million shares. So I have a lot of options on them. And if this thing hits $10, I will make 700% on my money in 2 years.
Wow.
Now, granted, it's got to hit $10, you know, so that's the gamble here. But
yeah, that's very interesting. So, yeah, I think that, you know, it's fascinating listening you talk about that, because that is literally, this is, back to Uber for a second, this is what Uber's problem is exactly this. So in areas where they could grow, you're going to have local companies that are going to better serve the...
It's embarrassing. It's embarrassing.
Right? Right?
It really is. And if they couldn't beat a local copycat of them, how the hell are they supposed to supply the network with drivers that can do... Or with cars that can autonomously drive? I mean, Travis, we don't talk enough about the fact that Travis knows. He knew since 2014 that eventually they would kick out the drivers. He was asked about it at a conference with J.Cal. And some reporter was like, or no, a driver was at the conference. He was like, are you going to get rid of me? And Travis was like, yeah. And the driver was like, you not care about human beings and empathy? And he was like, no, like you guys, eventually you won't have a job at Uber. And yeah. Part of him being so abrasive is probably why he got fired, right? But yeah.
Too autistic.
But he was also too early. 2014 was too early to be talking about that. You know?
Yeah. I remember when he went on an interview on the Colbert talk show. Where he was talking about launching Uber Eats, and then Colbert was like, he was railing him about, how come you treat your drivers so poorly? How come they can't do this? How come they don't have a union? How come, et cetera, et cetera, right? And Travis is like, I'm here to talk about Uber Eats. What the hell? You could tell he like left the interview with a stank face. So I can see why, but it's like, that's the unfortunate reality of like having that kind of leader for that company is you need a kind of a psycho to take these companies to the promised land. But they there's a potential that they will leave some sort of destruction behind their wake, quote unquote destruction. The reality is that a lot of the drivers that have been on Uber are on Uber because Uber pays them more for their time than the alternative of what they were going to do, what they wanted to do, right?
Yes.
So it's a market opener.
Yep.
And it would have been a market opener from inception until self-driving cars come, to give flexibility to those individuals that want to become drivers. And then Uber raising the price, creating surge pricing is how they add drivers to the network, right? Is by incentivizing people to go on the network for any period of time. So when you have self-driving cars, that entire forcing function disappears. Your drivers are no longer the supply side economics. It's the number of cars you have on the network that can drive themselves. And if Uber is unwilling and or incapable of courting enough of those units on their network to provide a certain level of service at a certain level of price, the entire thing collapses. And that is my prediction. And I will say it again, Amit, on this podcast, Uber is going to zero. I don't know when, but it's going to zero.
Dude, people love conviction.
Nothing personal. Nothing personal. Yeah.
Conviction is very important in investing. And you know,
conviction is very important in content creation, Amit.
That's awesome.
Hot takes take you to the promised land. Hans, go ahead.
I was gonna say, do we want to talk Trump and Elon?
Yeah, let's do it.
You want to do that, Hans? That's a good topic.
Sure, let's do it.
Well, Trump just said we're buddies again just now. So this is insanity, but it's also, you know, Elon said fate loves irony or whatever. It's incredible. So for those that don't know.
Real Housewives of Washington, D.C.
Last week, Elon was pissed off about the spending bill, said Trump was on the Epstein files, deleted the tweet two days later. Trump, throughout that entire time, was not taking a low blow. It was being very gracious throughout the whole thing. And then Elon apologized to
Trump. Was the one who made it personal about Elon first, though. Like, Elon was launching into Congress and how the bill sucked. He didn't say anything about Trump. And Trump was the one who made it personal in the first place. So it's like they did different things, but yes.
That is fair. It's just Trump didn't say he's on the Epstein list and touches little kids. Dude, I was at Palantir's AIPCon. So they didn't live stream it this time. They kind of just wanted to do it in-house and they posted the video later. I'm walking back from the presentation into the offices where they were going to have lunch and these demo sessions. And as I'm walking in, I see the tweet and I stop. And I'm just like, I look around like none of these people know that when they check their phone in the next 10 minutes, this is going to be the only thing that matters. And I'm just like, and then throughout the entire sessions, I start going up to people. I was like, hey, did you see what Elon said? And they're like, yep. And then like, and the mood switched because everyone was there for Palantir, but everyone knew that a nuke was just dropped on the president. And it was just the craziest.
So even at AIPCon, which is like nerd heaven for Palantir investors, right? This, or like Palantir fans, this is like the holy grail of like building the next 20 years on Palantir. The Elon Musk drops that post, and even there, people are like, what the fuck just happened?
Yeah.
Right?
I think I saw the tweet 2 minutes after it was posted. So I think I was the first person to see it. And then I go back to my normal part of what
because
I was
doing. Because you're a degenerate.
Because I'm a degenerate. I'm on Twitter all day. And then, you know, I start walking around and I just, you know, I start asking people, hey, did you see it? And I didn't even say, did you see Elon? Like, did you see it? And they knew what it was. And they were like, oh, it. And the funny thing is that because the New York Times has been attacking Palantir, and we can get into that, I thought this would take away from that. Because, like, why would the media care about Palantir and the New York Times if, like, Trump and Elon are going back and forth? But that got resolved so quickly that the media is going back to Palantir. So... You know,
so what was the vibe like? What was the sort of feedback you got like when it first broke and like you were talking to people about it? What was the general like consensus that people were saying?
What do the Palantir bros think about Elon's crazy tweet?
So I mean, I only talked to one Palantir employee. I talked to some random people there, but they didn't work at the company. But one of the employees there was just like, "This is crazy." She couldn't believe it's happening. She was kind of happy that it was shifting some of the attention away from all the hate Palantir was getting, but she was also just like, this is insanity. And she didn't think, the one thing I remember her saying is she doesn't think there was going to be a recovery from this. Like, this was this bad. Steve, one of my good friends who, you know, talks about the market all the time, he came on my show and he's like, Tesla's going to 150. They're not recovering.
I watched that episode.
And I'm listening to him and I was like, look, I think this is going to be an issue. And I think the stock was at 270 at the time, but he doesn't believe in the robotaxi thing. So, you know, this was another way for him to be like, this is going to get the street to go. Like, Steve, if they rallied 30% after that Q1, which is one of the worst quarters ever, this is not the thing that takes them down. Unless Trump unilaterally starts attacking Tesla, gets rid of the self-driving regulations. But within a couple of hours, you could tell he was taking it like a champ. He was taking it on the chin and he was just moving on from it. So the reaction was that everyone was very, very perplexed at how it was playing out. A lot of the MAGA people, obviously they took Trump's side, but they also didn't want to say Elon's horrible. You know, because they've embraced him. And a lot of the Elon people, like yourselves that have been covering him, you don't want to say Trump's a piece of shit because you understand that there's a lot of good things that his presidency has enabled, which is why Elon gave him a couple $100 million to become the president. But you also weren't going to say that this big, beautiful bill deserves to be praised as much as Trump was praising it versus critiqued as much as Elon was critiquing.
It was super mixed signals. I've never seen... as many people that I know are super pro Elon people, they're like, okay, bro.
Yeah.
Bro, what are you doing? Right? Like, okay. So the craziest thing is, number one, he posted it, but then he deleted it. That is like, if you're going to post it, like, come on, like, that's already a crazy enough thing to say, you know, towards the, like, pointing at the most powerful person in the world, and you go and fucking delete that thing, like, a day or two later, that, like, talk about completely defeating the purpose of why you were losing your shit in the first place, which is about the debt, and nobody's talking about the debt. Like, no, that has been completely lost. That has been completely and utterly lost. But it does seem like they're bros again. It does seem like they're bros again. They're hanging out. They hugged it out. They talked on the phone last night, I guess, or the night before. Right, I think was the post that broke. Yeah. So I do feel like all the risk of like towards Tesla and Elon is completely gone. That's what it feels like to me. Like, I think their relationship, I do think perhaps there is a situation here where Elon, let's say, quote unquote, crosses Trump again, quote unquote, whatever you want to deem as crossing, because Trump has a fluid interpretation of what crossing means, you know, then that could be bad for Tesla. But I mean, listening to his press conference from today, at least some clips of it, he's back to his usual, like, you know, very lauding of Elon, calling him a good friend, you know, he's great, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know. It's so, a very strange thing.
I mean, what do you think happens between now and the midterms between Trump and Elon? Do you want to, you can take that however you want. You can either give probabilities one way or the other. You can have a strong, spicy take and double down. What does the future look like?
Yeah, so it's confusing. The whole reason why Elon did this was also confusing because he's not going to stop the bill from passing. He can raise public awareness about how bad it is, but he's not going to stop. Like, we're not going to get to the point where Republicans legitimately go against Trump. So when he said 3 weeks ago, I am embracing GDP growth and margin expansion outside of Doge with spending cuts, that was an acknowledgement of him saying, look, the swamp's too deep. The best I can do is grow the economy. And I thought that was going to be the route. But then a week later, I don't know what happened, but he goes full on nuclear against the bill. And I'm like, the bill can't be that different from what it was 3 weeks ago. And it also can't be making you think you're that optimistic that you can use your influence to change it, because this is just a whole different battle. So having said that, going into the midterms, I think if the bill passes and the economy stays afloat, we don't get into a recession, which right now, based on the macro data I'm looking at, we're doing okay. I think the Republicans should be fine in the midterms. Trump should get what he wants. There would have to be something that breaks either in the stock market and the economy that really gets people to vote the other way. Now, the wild card is Elon starts this third party going into, or he starts campaigning for it into the midterms. I personally don't believe a third party is going to really get that much momentum. I mean, it's going to get some people that,
especially
like myself,
not now.
Yeah, especially like you. I think all three of us would be down for the third version of what the Democrats and Republicans could be like, the more moderate understanding of all two of those parties. But it's not going to get the majority of the country, and it's not going to beat the MAGA movement, which is just, you know, very deep.
But what about the, like, we always think about this in terms of presidential elections usually. What about a more moderate centrist voting bloc in the Senate and the Congress? I mean, it seems like Congress is one of the most broken things in the federal government right now, period. And is there, I mean, this is the thing that I'm wondering about and keeps me up at night, is how frustrated is Elon with Congress and what's he willing to do to try and fix it? And where does that put him and Trump?
Yeah, I mean, the problem with the senators and the House of Representatives is they have to be extreme in their jurisdictions to get elected. So AOC has to say crazy shit and not be moderate to beat her competitors. And there's some states where, you know, you can get a Joe Manchin, which was one of the reasons inflation didn't explode in 2021, because he didn't let the Inflation Reduction Act pass the way it was intended to. But those are few and far between. So I don't have any faith that we're going to have moderate people in the Senate or in the House. I mean, like, Marjorie Taylor Greene said she didn't even read the bill the other day. And I'm like, why couldn't you just put into ChatGPT or Grok and just get a summary? She's like, no, I missed this part of the bill. It's like, if they're not going to read the bill and we're voting for them, and probably, you know, most of them don't read the bill.
Well, Thomas Massie said that they put a whole bunch of new language in the bill literally the night before it passed. And that then, after doing that, this rules bill that they put on the floor actually then went back and retroactively modified the text of the bill that they just passed. It's like,
what a shit show.
How fucked up is that?
But dude, like, this is, I've had a cynical view of this for a long time, which is why when Elon went into Doge, I was such a big supporter of it, because I was like, dude, I would never try to do this. But I was like, he's trying. And then he, you know, it came to the same conclusion. Like, this is what Ray Dalio has been talking about all this. And it's not to be too doomerist. It's just more so like, hey, the structural antagonism that is set up within the hierarchy of the United States means that we're going to keep spending money. We're going to keep borrowing from future generations. Eventually it'll break. Hopefully not in our lifetime. Hopefully not in our kids' lifetimes. But until you have an Elon type of figure that really redesigns everything, it's going to be stuck like this, which means the only thing you can focus on is growth and AI and GDP and S curves that can deflate things so much because we have all these robots walking around that it actually makes costs of good go down, makes interest rates come down. Maybe we can pay back our debt. Like, there is a path to sustainability with growth, but it's probably not through cutting.
I think we had Emily Jashinsky from Undercurrents on our channel. She's one of the panelists on Breaking Points. The second time on our channel. So she's super deep in DC. And she's like kind of our political correspondent when Hans and I are both clueless, which is always. So she always comes in and gives us a hand. When we're having a conversation with her, I think the conclusion that I've personally come to is because of that dynamic where Congress holds the purse and there's almost 500 people in that chamber. What is it, 538 people? I don't know, between the Senate and the House, whatever that number is. All those people are, number one, there's no term limits. So you have a significant portion of that chamber that has been there for a long time that is corrupt either on purpose or unbeknownst to their knowledge because of how long they've been there, their relationships they've built, the money they're getting, et cetera, et cetera. And then you also have that dynamic you talked about where there's a lot of extremist takes that have to be taken on for you to win your jurisdiction. And then on top of that, you're in DC, which is its own bubble, right? So now you've created this thing where you have an unmovable object that is not going to move quick enough to solve the debt issue because austerity is not a variable. It's not a realistic thing for politicians to be like, yes, we should be better with our expenses. That's just not going to happen. We had a singular force in Elon and Doge trying to solve for that, and they ran into the wall of the swamp, and the swamp kicked them back and stomped their face in. And Elon got a black eye from that, literally, right? So that's impossible. What's the opposite side, which you talked about? Growth, okay? So the growth has to be at a level where it has to outstrip our spending now, but it also needs to outstrip the spending that we're for sure going to take on once we get that additional tax revenue from the growth, because under what scenario is this current system not going to want to spend more when there's more money to spend? Okay, so which means we're going to have to grow in even faster. So, but as we grow in even faster, what do we have to take on? Artificial intelligence. And if we take on artificial intelligence really fast, what does that happen? What does that do to the fabric of employment and labor? It's going to disrupt. It's going to disrupt industry faster. And so the outcomes we're going to get regardless in the next 10 to 20 years, and again, I don't want to be a doomerist, but I have a very hard time seeing an alternative here. We're either not going to grow fast enough and go into a debt spiral and just get overtaken by China, and that's the end of the American dream. Goodbye. Like, now we're going to be all Chinese, whatever that means. The world's going to be made in the vision of China, whatever that means, right? So that's one outcome. The other outcome is the United States grows so fast that the population gets displaced like crazy. And then you have internal uprising from people that have been left behind because we have to grow so fast to make up for our previous mistakes. And the collateral damage is people just lose their jobs. So how do we deal with that? So my biggest concern is like in the next 10 to 20 years, like this sort of like gigantic challenges are inevitable, completely inevitable. It's just which one is the more likely scenario, the growth scenario or the collapse scenario? And it feels like we're starting to go towards the growth scenario because of how much promise there is in artificial intelligence in those technologies. So that's kind of on my camp. That's the camp I'm on now. But what does that mean to the people that will be disrupted by that movement? So I don't know. It feels like, I don't know. I don't know if I sound like a crazy person or if I feel like if I sound too doomerist, but that's my conclusion now is I think we're going to get the AI boom. I think Tesla's going to dominate. I think Nvidia's going to dominate. I think Google's going to dominate. There's a chance OpenAI will dominate. There's all these different companies that are going to become unbelievable value creators and unbelievable cash flow generators. Okay. But that's going to come at a cost. And the cost is going to be the fabric of society is going to be forever changed very quickly because we had to fix our mistakes that we've made in the past around spending. So
It's going to be like a huge barbell. There's going to be the S&P 8 that like eats all, and then there's going to be a whole bunch of little tiny things that like $1,000 will. Well, no, like all the stuff in the middle is going to get crushed, and then a whole bunch of new stuff that's tiny, and like one person figuring out how to do this one cool thing that is this weird mixture of human plus whatever the new technology is, like that's going to flourish, and all this stuff in the middle is going to just get absolutely wrecked.
Yeah. So
I agree. I it's confusing, bro, because this Uber drivers are not going to have their job in the same way. UPS workers are not going to have their same job in the same way. Anthropic CEO came out yesterday and said, hey, blue collar or white collar workers, you guys aren't safe either. Like, you consultants, you're done. Like, you're, you know, so it's going to be a very, very weird time for society to deal with this, whether it's UBI, taxing the AI companies, et cetera. One thing I am optimistic on is that because there's going to be so much deflation as the cost of goods go down, that people will be more productive. Like, even you, right, you might not have to worry that much about paying a ton of video editors if you have all these AI services. Dude,
I'm literally using Manus right now. Have you heard of Manus?
No,
I
haven't heard of that.
It's like basically an AI agent tool. It's been running for an hour in the background. It's building a website for me for a workflow that I'm trying to solve for internally and while I'm on the podcast. And it's been doing that for an hour.
And that makes you more productive, means you can make more content, means you can make more revenue, which means you eventually you can make more taxes, you pay more taxes. But like not everyone's a content creator. So it's like, I wonder what's going to happen to those people in the middle and where productivity is going to come from for them and where purpose is going to come from. And that's a hard question to answer. It's a very hard question.
Is it an education gap? Do you think, like, for example, for the people that are going to be able to capitalize on the opportunities AI brings, is that a innate human thing? Or is that a, here are the opportunities that were in front of you while you were growing up that instilled these values in you that allowed you to take on those new technologies? What's the gap?
Absolutely, it's going to be the latter, which is that kids in fifth grade are going to grow up with AI, ChatGPT, like just like we grew up with the internet, and they're going to understand that this is the way I should. I mean, Mark Andreessen had a great interview yesterday where he was basically saying AI will be the epicenter of how everything operates, and humans will have to learn agents and agentic workflows and how models will answer questions more than like a calculator or Google can. And so kids will become native with that, and that'll be incredibly productive for them. However, the people that are not 10 years old right now and that are in their 20s and 30s, it's a question of ambition, because the world is changing in front of you. And if you, and that doesn't mean you have to be an entrepreneur and build a company, but that if you are ignoring the fact that your white collar job right now might start not to be commoditized in the next 5-10 years, and you're going to need skill sets when you go to apply for a job, like Carp from Palantir, he was talking about, they're not looking for the best engineers anymore. They're looking for the creative engineers, because the engineering part's going to be done by Claude, a lot of the coding. So how do you create from a practical perspective and an artistic perspective, the entire theme at Palantir's AIPCon was about art, in order to work with AI? And that's going to be the hard part that I don't know how many people are going to be able to adapt to over the next decade.
That is fascinating. So wow, that is so unbelievable to hear from Palantir. So they're saying, just to make sure I fully understand what you just said, they are saying that the technical aspect of building, specifically around engineering the product, like the nitty gritty, get into the details of building the thing, the 10x engineers that they would have hired in the past, why would you hire that 10x engineer who's going to be likely his or her best quality or skill, when you can do the same exact thing with an LLM / AI workflow that's 1,000 times engineer for 1/10 or 1/100 or 1/1000th of the cost, and instead focus on hiring the talent that is going to be able to leverage that tool, that skill and talent is going to be different from the skill and talent of that 10x engineer.
And just take into account the fact that the platform has reached a scale now where the challenges that they're trying to solve are different, that, you know, the plumbing under the hood has already been developed by those 10x engineers, those 100x engineers for years and years and now decades. And so, yeah, it's like, I don't know how much of that, maybe you have a perspective on this, Amit, is a function of the changing nature of the problems that they're solving today compared to the problems that they have solved in the past versus now the, you know, the guy who's the hardcore, you know, deep in the weeds guy who understands how to use Fortran to access these ancient COBOL mainframes, like all that shit's already in the rearview mirror. You don't need that guy anymore.
Yeah. I mean, when Karp was talking about this, it's exactly what you said, Farzad. Like, they don't need the best engineering talent. They need you to know how to be a 10x engineer, but they need you to also have creativity attached to that. Because if you have no creativity, then it's like, what are you offering to them? And what, to your point, Hans, they built the software. It took them 20 years. They built it. They have all the patents. Now they have different challenges of how to apply that inside of a business. So for example, Palantir has this forward deployed engineering model where they send engineers to the clients to be able to do all the work. I interviewed one of the employees there that says they have now internally built a tool that will be shipping to the rest of their customers probably by the end of this year called AI FDE, which is an AI forward deployed engineer. Meaning if BP says, hey, Palantir, we need some help, yada, yada, doing this, they are giving them a AI version of a forward deployed engineer that is going to do a lot of the nitty gritty stuff that you would ask an engineer to do. And now that engineer, it's not like it's losing his job. That engineer can figure out, hey, how do I make BP software even more valuable so they keep paying us $30 million or whatever a year so that we can keep growing the business?
Or
so,
he can support five businesses instead of one.
Exactly. Exactly. And so when he was talking to me about this, I was like, holy crap. Of course, the battery gets exhausted. But it was like, dude, if this guy is going to be able to essentially leverage his talent or his AI FDE to solve all the like random, you know, things that you don't need to worry about as a creative person, and then you can shift your focus on creating more value for the business, they're going to be paying more money to Palantir. Like, it becomes obvious where this goes. And that's why you need creative talent. You can't just have someone who's doing random codes to like fix bugs. It's like, that's not valuable anymore.
Yeah. So that speaks very deeply to the thesis that I've had around the kind of talent that will be leveraging artificial intelligence tools. So like the art of building, the art of entrepreneurship, the art of picturing the end result, visualizing the end result, very accurately visualizing what you're trying to build. That becomes a lot more valuable than this is how I actually build it. Like, it, you know, it's two different. I find that it's two different sides of the brain. It's very hard to find somebody who is very good at the technical, like actually sitting down and building the thing, and then visualizing what they're looking for, like visualizing what they could build, because they get lost so much in the detail of like, oh wow, that's how you build the thing. Like, and they become really knowledgeable about how to permutate that thing a thousand different ways. And I think that's a big difference between like, and this is why CEOs and typically leaders are rarely, and like if you remove sort of like the top 1% of companies or even the top 0.1% of companies, you have that rare mixture of unbelievable talent when it comes to the technical, but also unbelievable talent when it comes to the visualization and the concept and the conceptualizing what they're trying to solve for. That's your Elons, that's your Jensens, those are the Google guys, right? When they started the company, that's what they seem like. They have those two skill sets at like 10 out of 10, right? But then when you start going down the list, the ones that are 10 out of 10 on the technical but like lower on the creative, those guys tend to be the bottom tier, the bottom half tier of like an organization from total earnings potential perspective, because they're in there doing the nitty gritty work. And then the top half, especially at the higher executive levels, are the ones that can conceptualize and communicate what they're looking for. And they know how to find things that they're looking for, right? But those folks, if they're just partner with the tool that will do that work for them, that human doesn't serve any value anymore. So it's like for the stage that we're going down, being creative and being artful is a significantly more important skill set than learning how to do the technical work.
It's the only thing that matters.
Crazy.
That's it. And like, who would have thought 10 years ago, creativity would get the premium, you know? Because 5 years ago, the hashtag learn to code, stupid hashtag, right, was trending. And it's like, now it's like, dude, you learn to code. If you're not that good at coding, who the fuck cares about coding? Like, anything can code now.
Yeah. And I think there's like a bigger philosophical conversation too. It's like, how do humans tap into their creative selves? It's by removing distractions. I think that's the best way to be creative is to remove distractions. Like you, like, yeah, so like, well, I'm like the scrolling, right? Like,
but the here's a good question.
Yeah.
Let's say you remove distractions. Do most people, in your opinion, have the internal desire, ambition, whatever you want to call it, that gets them to put out 5,000 videos about Tesla and build a community? Like, do most people have that in them that they want to create? Like, creating is hard, bro. Like, creating, like being able to consistently create, it's not, like, do most people actually want to go through the shit of getting told they're an idiot 500 times in a live chat and having to deal with that cyberbullying? Like,
no,
it's,
but they don't need to. They don't need to, because I think AI is going to align an individual's innate talent with what the market's looking for in an AI world.
So it will be a tool to help you accelerate that talent, but
yes,
it requires that internal talent, right?
I think everyone's got a talent.
No, I agree with that. But the better question is, it requires that a lot of people cover Tesla. You and Hans are winning for a reason, right? Like, there's a level of competitiveness with that creativity.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Like, there's some Tesla YouTuber can use all the AI tools they want, but if they don't have the magic that Hans and Farzad can bring to the discussion,
if they read a bad comment in the YouTube section, will that derail their entire trajectory because they don't have a thick enough skin to be called a retard?
Yeah, we don't care that they call us retards because we are.
Because we agree.
So then the question is, does AI give people a thick skin? Because that's intangible, right? Mm. That's an intangible. It's like my sister, she loves poetry. I've read her poetry. Like, I think she would be up there. And I generally say this, one of the top poets in the world, but she cannot handle people's criticism and feedback. So she's never put it out.
No, dude,
I've told her to make an Instagram account, but just get your poetry. She can't do it. She doesn't want to see what people have to say about her stuff. And that's who she is.
You know what you should do for her?
You should run her Instagram poetry.
Don't even tell her.
Dude, I've tried. But also there's a level of just like, you know, that's her private thoughts. And
of course.
I don't want to put that out there, but like I've read it and she's wanted to perform it for me. So like, you know, it's been a couple of years since she's really read me a poem, but she would make me sit in a room while she's performing the poem and I'm listening to it. I'm like, dude, if people heard this, like how much better would people's lives be if they could relate to some of the stuff you're talking about? But she can't handle the feedback. I'm over here going live 2 times a day. I can't wait for the feedback. I'm like, dude, give me what you got. Like, let's do it.
That's why your chat is so fucking unhinged.
And they're unhinged.
Love it.
But I don't know if AI can give everyone that type of intent.
That's such a good question.
It's hard. And if they don't have it, can they really survive in the creator economy? Because all of us know how hard it is for A, to get the attention, B, to monetize the attention, and then C, to sustain the attention to build a growing brand. Like, it's really ruthless. It's a hard game in this attention economy. And for creativity, I think that this is unquestionable. Creativity requires attention. Because you could have the greatest book in the world, the greatest song in the world, the greatest pop, if no one's listening, which means you need to understand distribution, you're stuck listening to it yourself.
Do you think you can teach that?
No. I've had people come up to me. I was in DC the other day and someone came up to me. He recognized me from YouTube. So he was like, hey, I'm thinking of doing my own thing. He was like, what's your advice? And I hate the question. Because I'm like, first of all, if you're asking for advice, you're not even, it's you can't ask for advice for
this. Don't do it. Yeah. My advice to you is don't do it.
Yeah. Like us three and my creator friends, like Tanner, we can talk about strategies and tips because we're in the game. We're doing it. You have to get into the game to even have the ability to ask how you can get better. But to ask that blanket question,
like, and if you need Amit's permission to get in the game, you're never going to make it in the game.
Dude, in 2021, I took no one's permission and I started making videos on Palantir. No one. I wasn't a tech expert. I definitely wasn't an investing expert. I was some random guy in his parents' house. I'm still in my parents' house, but in August, I'm moving out. And I was thanks to Palantir, quite frankly.
Where to?
Jersey City. So it'll be 20 minutes from New York.
Okay.
It's my first like real luxury apartment. So, you know, excited to
nice.
But I didn't take anyone's permission. I just said, all right, let's put some videos. And then I saw the algorithm. I saw the views. I saw the community. There is no rules to this shit. You go out there.
You kick Tom Nash's ass.
Okay, well, no comment. I don't know. My fear is in an AI world where you need that internal drive to just say, screw everything. I'm just going to put my content out there into the world. AI can help you put the content out, but will it make you want to put the content out and be a real creator? You know?
That's such a very interesting question. So the question, so do you envision this sort of AI, is this AI world, is it going to trend more and more towards attention? Like, do you think that people's creations by default will have to be public? And so therefore, because they're public, that's going to filter out anybody who's not comfortable in the public eye. Is that your thesis?
Well, yeah, it's like that's like de facto. You have to, like, these content platforms, and that's why I'm so happy Elon bought X, is like it gives you the freedom to have distribution. I mean, I think he tweeted that, or he posted an algorithm update that they're doing, so now small accounts will be able to get more visibility. Like, you need someone who's helping people get that distribution. So the platforms are there, YouTube, X, et cetera. The ability to get people's attention is there, but then being able to be symbiotic with the platforms to figure out how to work on top of them, that's incredibly difficult. And the people that do it have a very lucrative career if you do it at the highest of levels, the Mr. Beast, et cetera, because it's really freaking hard to do it. And so AI will give you all the tools to do it, but objectively, creativity, in my opinion, does not matter unless it has the ability to gain distribution. It can matter to you, it can matter to your family, to your friends, et cetera, but if you want to build a career out of it, you got to get the world to listen to that music. And it's hard to distribute content out there into the world. And I don't know if AI makes you better at that. AI helps you, but like the underground rapper right now that's going to be the next Jay-Z, he's going to do it regardless of AI.
Yeah. So so what about all the people that have the drive but don't yet know what they should be building or what their talents are good for? Do you think AI is going to bring those guys and girls to the forefront?
So the
opposite problem.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the way to figure out what you want to put out into the world is you go through trial and error.
Hey, everyone, this is Future Hans. Sorry for the very abrupt ending to this podcast. Unfortunately, we ran into a lovely StreamYard recording error. I think it was attached to the Google Cloud service going down the other day. And so we ended up having to just cut this conversation off right there. Hopefully we can pick it up next time with Amit in a future recording session. But for now, we will just have to catch you next time. And we hope you have a wonderful weekend.